Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Fiona Williams about her contemporary novel, The House of Broken Bricks. Fiona has a bachelor's degree in biological sciences from the University of Westminster and an MA in creative writing from Bath Spa University. Originally from Southeast London, she now lives with her family on the Somerset Levels. In this episode, we discuss using nature writing to reflect the story's mood, reading work aloud to find rhythm and melody in a sentence, and how exposing the publishing process is for introverts. But before we hear that, here's Fiona with an excerpt from The House of Broken Bricks.
It's the middle of the night. I creep downstairs wrapped in my dressing gown when everyone's asleep. Better to be up and busy than lying there frustrated. The house is so still, I can almost hear the murmur of the river through the bricks. The flagstones in the kitchen are glacial beneath my bare feet. My slippers are upstairs. I'm quieter without them. There's still some heat left in the Rayburn, but not nearly enough, so I shove in wood until the log basket is completely empty. Outside, there's not a drop of light in any direction, as though the entire world has disappeared. We could be the only people left, alone, in this house, oblivious. It's the same routine. A furtive cup of tea followed by some sort of bacon. My new habit. I'm good at it now, stealthy. I cream sugar and butter, crack eggs and sift flour without making a sound. Not that I need to worry. Once asleep, they don't wake up until morning. Tonight I decide on blackberry muffins and take from the freezer a couple of bags of misshapen fruit, picked most likely by Max at the end of summer, from the brambles that border the sheep field. They begin to thaw on contact with the batter. I fold in air with my large wooden spoon, one eye on the clock. All these cakes and I can barely eat them. Mama thinks I'm losing weight. Says this life doesn't agree with me, that I'm losing the coveted Sullivan backside and hips. Mama says a lot of things. So does Peaches. Maybe they're right. Oh, what am I thinking? 30 minutes until the muffins are done. So I sit and sip my tea and stare at the reflected woman in the window. Is this really what I've become? Finally roasting hot, the Rayburn drums into life and thrusts boiling water through the narrow copper pipes leading out of the kitchen, along the hall skirt into the tepid radiators. It taps quietly, in an animated rhythm that disturbs the silence. Sometimes it feels like this house is alive. The warmth brings with it the honeyed smell of bacon that makes my eyelids heavy and reminds me of sleep. I'm taken back to past summers, spur-of-the-moment picnic teas in the orchard, the boys keeping wasps off the jam sandwiches, and all those plump, juicy blackberries that overflowed from empty ice cream tubs and left our fingers pricked and sticky. A creak on the stairs brings me back. I freeze, my mug at my lips. For a moment I think it's sunny, awakened by a bad dream perhaps, or by the low rumble of the heating. As a baby, he was the one who stirred most often during the night to summon me from my sleep, more in need than Max of a feed or cuddle. If it is him, I won't send him back to bed. He could keep me company until the muffins are ready, and then we'd eat one each with a spoonful of cold custard straight out of the tin. Our secret. I wait, but no one comes. It's only the wooden tread stretching as the house warms up.
Hi Fiona, welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The House of Broken Bricks.
Hi Chloe, thank you so much for inviting me. It's such an honour. This podcast has become such a rite of passage. And so to be on it, it's just, oh, it's wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's lovely to hear. Can you start by introducing The House of Broken Bricks to us? Tell us what it's all about.
Okay, so The House of Broken Bricks, it's a novel that's really looking at belonging in place, really. It's looking at the ties that bind us to family, to community, to landscape, and the secrets that can sort of threaten to tear these ties apart. The story is mainly set on the Somerset Levels, and it follows the year in the life of a family that's taken to the very brink. There's Tess, who's the mum in the family, and she has moved from London. She's left behind her really close-knit British Jamaican family to live in this really small farming village where her husband Richard was born. They live with their sons Max and Sunny, who are fraternal twins of different colours. So Max presents as white, whereas Sunny presents as black.
Yeah, and that adds so much tension in the novel. There's loads of tension between all of the characters, and I'll kind of tread carefully because there's certain things that we want to keep for the reader to discover as they enjoy the novel. I wondered if you had a particular starting point for this book, whether you can remember what that kind of early inspiration was. Where did it all come from?
I think the novel's come from so many things. You know, this is quite a common question, you know, what inspired you? I moved from London. Well, I'd moved all over the place, but I started off in London and I moved to rural Somerset. So I think my experiences are definitely woven through the book, and I really wanted to share some of those experiences. There were many questions that I had and my family had about perceptions of identity and belonging, and some of the trials that Tess kind of goes through are things that I've experienced myself. Although I really want to do stress that the novel's not autobiographical. My husband's adamant that people know that he is not Richard. He's really worried about that. But I wanted to capture some of the things that we have experienced and that other people that I know have experienced. I think particularly as well, I wanted to look at it from the point of view of British children of mixed heritage, you know, and who gets to decide if someone is local or not. Because a lot of villages in Somerset, they say that if you've got more than three generations in the graveyard, then you can kind of class yourself as a local. But, you know, for example, what if you have got three generations, but your mum's black? You know, are you still allowed to call yourself local? And will other people see you as that? Also, I think the book is really, really inspired by just the wild beauty of the Somerset Levels. It's such a beautiful place. And I really wanted to write a love letter almost to the landscape as well, because I think that it's not in novels very often. I haven't read it very often, you know, and it's such a beautiful area, so I really wanted to kind of pay homage to that as well. I also wanted to kind of share some observations of just modern village life. I mean, we all have these kind of quite nostalgic views of what village life might be like, but I did want to touch on you know, some of the realities of living in the village. You know, lots of villages are facing flooding, pub closures, Airbnbs springing up all over the place, you know, and what it's like to be old in a village, access to transport, that kind of isolation that can come quite quickly as you age. So these are all things that I've kind of seen around me and have had friends and neighbours go through, and I really wanted to kind of share that in the novel.
Yeah, I think you captured that so well. And I've also heard your novel described as this like pastoral novel describing the English countryside, which you do beautifully. And I wondered, this is tied in and woven in between this rising tension in the household. We've got Richard and his allotment, and we've got the river, and we've got all these sort of the nature around them, but inside the house is this, you know, boiling point. Can you talk about that juxtaposition between the two?
I think that I wanted to use the beauty and the abundance of the nature and the landscape to balance out some of the heavier things, because the book does touch on some really quite heavy topics. And so it was quite helpful for me to have the landscape to kind of frame everything around. I wanted to show that even when things are going badly, you're still surrounded by natural beauty and that nature keeps on going. It doesn't stop just because life's fallen apart or things aren't going how you want them. But even though nature is the bigger picture here, I really wanted to look at it with a child's eye and capture that wonder and that awe that children feel when they look at tiny things. You know, when I wrote the book, I wrote the majority of the book sat at the kitchen table. And there's a big window to the side. And so all the way through writing, I'd, you know, stare into space, procrastinating, and just looking at the kind of fields outside and the trees, watching the seasons turn. And it's impossible, it was impossible not to be affected by that. Whenever I went out walking, because we've got dogs that go out walking really early along the riverbank, you know, I'd always take a notebook and pen and jot down everything I saw. Because I think the landscape and the nature in it is really important. And I wanted to tie the characters to the landscape and show that their relationships with nature are as meaningful as their relationships with each other and with people. I think as well, I also wanted them to use the nature to help reflect the story's mood, because we go through the seasons from autumn to summer, and the mood of the novel is very much in relation to those seasons. So I wanted readers to feel the change in the seasons and feel the change in the characters' moods in relation to that, definitely.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask about perspective that you use because it didn't, I'm really bad at noticing perspective until I kind of suddenly went, oh, okay. All the characters apart from Richard are written in first person, and Richard is written in a third person. And I'd love if you could talk about that choice. I kind of have an idea of why, but I'd love to hear your kind of thinking behind it.
I mean, it was a really difficult decision to make, and I did play around quite a bit at the beginning with different perspectives and points of view, trying to work out what to do with everybody. I think for Tess and the boys, I really wanted the reader to be in their shoes and to experience, you know, firsthand the kind of complex and conflicting emotions that they feel. Particularly for the boys, I really wanted there to be that immediacy of traveling around with them and connecting with the space and with other members of the community. But for Richard, I think I wanted to keep him somewhat more distant than with the other characters. You know, he's a white guy, he's in his home village, he's quite comfortable there with his identity. And so I think retrospectively now, I look back and think that I think I wanted to marginalize him in some way and keep him on the periphery a little bit. But I think the main reason was because I didn't want him to reveal what was going on in the story. You know, there's a lot going on in Richard's world that we don't know about, and I didn't want anyone to pick up on it too soon. Like, I didn't want readers to have access to his internal thoughts until the right moment.
I'm not going to obviously give what that is away, but I wondered how hard that was for you to kind of write around this secret, I guess, to kind
Very
of avoid it. Very hard, yeah.
Very, very hard.
By the time I reached the kind of, I guess, reveal, I was like, wow, that must have been really difficult
It
because,
was hard.
I mean, I don't read like a lot of books with kind of, I guess you'd call them twists, but reveals in that sense, and I'm terrible at noticing the clues or anything. And then I kind of thought about it, and I thought, oh, Fiona's so clever. Like I really thought you did that so well because it didn't feel forced. It didn't feel like you were purposely avoiding telling the reader. It was done in a very artful way, and I think it must have been really hard to do that.
It was very hard. I think I didn't want to hide everything and it be like a big da-da at the end. I did want it to be that if you were looking for the clues, there was lots of clues there to be found. I think as well for me in the writing, I was so looking forward to it. So that kind of helped me kind of go, oh, not yet, not yet. You know, be patient, get to it. Because I feel that the book is quite heavy in places, and for me, the reveals that come later are a bit of a treat after having gone through all the hard times. So yeah, it was. I think that's what kept me going with that, and it was quite fun to do it and think of ways of dropping it in but not showing it. Yeah, definitely. Poor Richard, he has a hard
That's
time.
we're being super cryptic. Hopefully people have read the book, they will understand totally what we're talking about. Otherwise just read the book and then you'll know. There's such a gorgeous, well, one of the things I noticed straight away is that your writing has such a beautiful and kind of interesting rhythm to the voice, and I wondered, I think for some writers that kind of voice just comes out straight away. Draft number one, that's the voice on the page. But other writers have to work at it, and that doesn't come as naturally. But I wondered for you, was the voice one of the first things that came out, or did you later go back and edit it?
No, this is something that has really, really, really surprised me because I didn't even know I'd written it rhythmically until after it was written. Other people told me. I had absolutely no idea. So it's been a real eye-opener for me. My husband has said that I apparently when I am writing, I hum, which I didn't know either.
Right.
I hum my sentences. So I'm making sure there are enough beats in the bar. Like, and I've realized now that I do like melody in the sentences somehow. I don't know why. I don't know if it's a Virgo thing or just a neurospicy thing. I don't know where it's come from, but I like rhythm. I didn't even know I did. So no, I it wasn't intentional at all. It came out that way. And then in the editing stage and looking back on it then I did see it then because other people kept mentioning it and I thought, oh yeah, I do. And when I read my sentences out loud, I do listen for, I don't know, the tunefulness of it all. And I can tell if a word is wrong because the tune doesn't sound
Yeah,
right.
I totally, I
don't
completely,
know where that comes from.
I completely relate. It just feels wrong, doesn't it? It just sounds wrong.
It sounds wrong.
And I mean, I do sometimes read my work aloud, usually when I've kind of done a couple of drafts, but sometimes even in my head, I'm just like, nope, that doesn't, that I need another, I need a short sentence here, or I need a, you know, another word here. And it's funny, isn't it? Like, how
It's
often do
funny.
you read your work aloud? Are you reading it quite
I
often?
read it aloud a lot. I read aloud a lot. That's been something that I've always done all the way through. I read it aloud. If I've just written like a whole solid piece that I'm feeling like, okay, this piece is working for me, I will read it out straight away and I'll know instinctively from reading it out whether or not it really is working. And I do it for everything. I do it for emails as well. And I find myself humming and reading out loud my emails and like, hi, da 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 da. And yeah, so I think I do a lot because I think it's a different part of your brain that hears it and accesses it. And I think it really helps to see if it's working or not. It's really funny because I've got students now and I talk to them. One of my biggest pieces of advice that I give them is read your work out loud and record yourself. You know, that was the worst thing. Sometimes I'd record it just so that I could hear it read back to me and think, yeah, that does sound okay. It works okay. So yeah, definitely something I'd recommend.
We've sort of touched on one aspect of the book that was challenging, but I wondered whether there was any other aspects of the writing process that were particularly difficult during this book.
I think the biggest challenge for me, especially at the beginning, was juggling my time with family and work. I was working as a freelance medical writer at the time with kids at home, aged 10 and 6. They were roughly around 10 and 6 at the time. So there were so many demands. I had demands of school. And I also, I'm working, I guess if I think about my work, I was working as a medical writer. I've worked in the kind of pharmaceutical kind of field for a very long time, and I have a science background, and trying to switch my brain between science and science writing and that kind of really formal way of writing to then switching to kind of creative writing for the novel was really, really hard. And there were lots of days where I couldn't write anything because I was just in the wrong gear and I couldn't switch my brain into the right mode for it. And I think the challenges of having kids at home, also it was the book I'd started writing the book before COVID came, before COVID hit us, but ended up sort of finishing it off during lockdown, and I had kids at home trying to homeschool. And I ended up writing lots of it just sat on the sofa with them sat next to me watching movies and stuff. And it's, you know, lots of people have quite precise and lovely writing routines. I'm really envious. I think wake up at 5, 2 hours of writing, not in my house. It just
No.
doesn't happen. I literally have to write whenever and wherever I can, wherever I get a gap. And I think that's why I chose to do an MA, to protect my writing time and to give me some deadlines to work against. But I think then my next challenge, I think when I went on the MA, was sharing my work, because at that point I hadn't really shared it with anybody ever. And so that was quite nerve-wracking. I had a science degree, I was coming into humanities subject, and everyone else had an English or classics background, and I was really worried about it, like was my work going to be up to scratch? But so I think that was quite a hard book for it in the end.
I'm intrigued there because you mentioned your MA. At what point did you think, okay, I enjoy writing, or I think I've got a talent, and I'm going to do an MA? What at what point was that kind of decision?
Yeah, I think it was because I started writing, and then I really started to worry that I didn't know if what I was writing was any good. I thought I've got no one to ask if I'm even doing this right. And I really wanted to be somewhere or be involved in something where I would be getting feedback. And I did think about going, I was actually thinking going back to do a BA, like all the way back to the beginning. But then, you know, obviously, with work and kids and life and the age that I am, I was like, that's really not feasible. So I thought, well, I'll try for an MA because it's a shorter course and I could fit it in around work and kids. So that's kind of the impetus for applying. I didn't think I'd get on. So it was a case of just, I'll give it a go and see. And then I got on the program, and then it all kind of led from there, really.
Yeah, because after that 2021, you won the Bridport. I'm gonna, it's a long title, Bridport Prize, Catherine Andrews
Very long.
First Novel Award. So, first of all, like, how did, well, what made you apply for this competition? Because you've done your MA, and then I guess, was there a period in between where you were still working on your writing or thinking about kind of, did you enter other competitions? Like what
I
kind of
did.
led you to this competition?
I think on the MA, one of the pieces of advice that we got was, you know, once you've kind of got something worth showing, you need to kind of think about sharing it with agents, putting it out for competitions. So the MA had finished. We were still in the midst of lockdown, I think, at that time. I can't remember. And I have to be honest, the writing was dwindling away. I lost the structure and the support of the MA. I got went back to work. Kids were at home doing homeschooling, and I really felt that was the end of it for me. I felt like it had just been a really wonderful experience and I'd had a great time, but now time to get back to real life and crack on. And so I remember the advert came round for the Bridport Prize, and there was another prize at the same time that was also being advertised. And I thought, well, I've got my stuff here. I can just do a submission. We'd just been practicing kind of writing pitches and synopses, and so I thought, well, I've got everything I need for it. It doesn't require much effort. I'm just going to send it off, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I'll just try and see. But I really honestly sent it off and then did not think about it ever again. It was a case of, okay, I've done that, and then I just carried on with my life, didn't think about it at all. And then I remember the email came out to say that I had made the long list, which was, that in itself for me was a huge shock, an absolutely huge shock. You know, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, someone's actually read it and liked it. And with the other prize, I didn't hear anything. I didn't make any lists. So I thought, okay, that's obviously as far as it's going to go. And I was really chuffed. I was so happy just with that. But then, you know, it kept going on and on. And then to finally win, oh, I cried. I cried so much. It was a lot of crying. You know, and I feel like it gave me validation, definitely, that I was a writer. Because up until that point, I didn't call myself a writer. I was just somebody who'd done the writing MA and had a go at writing, but I didn't think of myself as a writer. And I think at that point it was like, am I allowed to say it now?
You are definitely allowed
Which was quite nice.
to.
And
You
then
are an award-winning writer.
it just blew up from there, and
Yeah.
So quickly, the whole thing was just such a explosion of things happening one after the other.
Did after you won, did you have interest from agents and things after that?
Straight away, immediately, several agents got in touch, and I hadn't even finished the novel at that point because they don't like look at that entire novel. They look at it was about half, and so it was a case of, oh my God, I've actually got to finish writing. I remember Christmas was coming, and I got an agent really, really quickly, like so quickly. And she was like, come on, you got to get it finished. And I remember writing over that Christmas period, and I do love a deadline. I think it's because of the jobs I've had in the past. So I had a deadline, and it was like, right now I've got a deadline. It woke me up again because I'd kind of put that writing head to sleep, and it was like, off we go. And I was up late in the night writing, and I really enjoyed it actually because it's I felt energized by it. So yeah, it was a very exhausting but exciting moment.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What would you say to anyone who is out there that is like you were and saying, I'm not a writer, I'm just someone that likes to write, or I'm an aspiring writer, and they're nervous about applying for competitions because they don't think they're good enough or they don't think they're ready? What would your advice be to them?
I think just go for it, really. Always just go for it, because you just never know, do you? You never, never know where it's going to lead. If anyone had asked me if I thought I'd even make a long list, I would have said, of course I won't, but I'm just doing it because I want to practice kind of submitting things and thinking about my work. I mean, and it does come down to luck in a lot of ways, because I mean, I submitted to two competitions at the same time, one and didn't even make the long list on the other. So you know, it's you're going to get knockbacks, and you might not get anywhere, but then you just might. I think even just the preparing for submitting to a competition is good practice as well, and it does help. It forces you to think about your work in a more industry focused way. You know, how do you describe what you've written, which is a really hard thing, I think, for a lot of writers to do. I found it really hard.
You mentioned that you hadn't finished the novel when you submitted it, and then obviously you worked with an agent. So how did your novel change much from the kind of competition entry to the final published book? Because I saw an interview with you where you'd won, and you were talking about the novel, and I thought, I can see the novel in what you're saying, but I also think the novel may have changed a little bit. Did it change much?
It didn't change structurally. Structurally, it has stayed the same. The only thing that I did do with the help of my agent and then later my editor was maybe move a few things around in terms of timing, just to help with pacing. In terms of, and there was quite a, the novel was a lot bigger originally as well. So there was, and I knew that it needed to be trimmed down. So they definitely helped me taking out the bits that just were lovely. They said they're lovely, but not necessary. So that was quite a useful exercise for me as well, because I don't have that kind of writing experience of trying to work out what's needed and what isn't needed. So no, it didn't change. The idea that I had from the beginning, it's still the same now. I think things had probably changed before the Bridport Prize in some ways. The novel that I kind of finished my MA with and then what I ended up submitting to the Bridport Prize, that did change. Because I did show it to some agents earlier on and got some feedback. This was in the very early stages, which part of the kind of university kind of did lots of kind of events where you could kind of pitch your work and get some feedback. And I think that I had thought to myself that I had been trying really hard to write a novel in the shape of what I thought a novel should be. And then I actually got to the point where I thought, I just don't think I want to do that. I want to just write what I want to write in the way that I want to write it. So it did change a bit then. And that's when I kind of broke it down into the chapters that it is in now. And that hasn't changed even through the editorial process.
Mm, that's interesting. So a question that I ask everyone that comes on the podcast is mainly about the kind of ups and downs of being a debut novelist, because I think on the outside, a lot of people think it's all sunshine and roses and everyone's dreams are coming true. And obviously it is amazing. It's such a privilege. We all feel so thrilled to have our books out there in the world. But there are ups and downs emotionally, kind of practically, things that maybe you weren't expecting to happen that have happened, or things that you thought, you know, you didn't understand about the process. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what advice you would have to next year's cohort. So when I interview the 2025, what would your advice be to them now who are going through it all? And what do you wish you'd known way back when? Because you signed your contract 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
And you are, I'm sure you're a very different person now. So what would your advice be? What do you wish you'd known?
I think the first thing probably is based on that. And I think it would be to pace yourself. It's a long, long road from even getting the publishing deal to actually seeing it in print. It's a long road. You know, you've jumped all the hurdles, you've got your agent, you've got your book deal, and you think, well, hey, I'm off. And then there's this whole roller coaster of emotions that go on for all these years, and you've got to contend with it, you've got to find a way to live with it. So I think that it can be hard. And I think one of the advice I'd give is during that period is to find something else to do, so that you're not kind of fixating on it. Because it's a long time, and a lot of worry and doubts, and that's when anxiety starts to pop up. I mean, I'm doing a PhD. I started my PhD in 2022. And so I'm busy, and keeping busy in this process has been really, really helpful, because I've got other things to think about and to worry about. I think as well, bits of advice I would give is to, well, everyone says this, you know, not to compare yourself with others. And it's incredibly hard not to do it, especially with social media showing you what everybody else is doing. So you can't even hide from it. So I have found that sometimes I do try and hide from that, just so that I don't get caught up in that self-doubt and that worry that, you know, because everybody's journey is different and the experiences are different. So I think those are things that I would definitely give as advice to people coming through. Also, I think that it is, like you just said, it's a wonderful and amazing experience, and it's something that lots of people will never get to experience. So I do keep trying to tell myself not to worry and to try and have fun with it. Because like you say, everyone thinks that it's this exciting, wonderful thing, and it is, and it really, really is. And it's reminding myself constantly that that is what it is, and not to get caught up in anxiety and worry all the time.
Yeah, it is difficult, and it is emotional. And I think because it doesn't matter what you write, art is so personal, and it's very hard not, like you're saying about the comparison thing, It's hard not to think it's personal.
Mm.
Whereas, and I talk about this all the time in the podcast about, business versus art, business versus, the thing that you've created from yourself. And then suddenly it's out in the world and it's a product and it needs to be sold, and it needs to be sold in a particular way. And there are things that we don't have control over. And you might sit there thinking, well, hang on, that person over there is getting this, I'm not getting this, or, all those sorts of things that go through your head. And you have to almost just think, I'm proud of my work, I'm proud of my book. People will read it, people will find it, and people will pick it up and think, I think everyone I know has had a message from someone to say, this book was brilliant, or this book is my favorite book of the year, or this book has kept me awake at night, whatever it is, in a good way, I'd say.
Yeah.
So it's difficult, it is hard, but you have to kind of, like you say, remember the positives and kind of concentrate on them
You
as much as
do, because
possible.
it's, we're in a really, really lucky position. It's a dream that has come true, that so many people have. So yeah, it's important to try and feel proud about how far you've come and what you've achieved, without looking at everybody else and seeing what they're achieving. One of the hardest things that I have found is that you write a book and you think that you've written a book and off it goes and it's going to go out there in the world and do its thing. And I wasn't quite prepared. I didn't know at the beginning of when I signed a book deal how much of yourself you have to put into that whole process too. How everyone loves to hear personal stories, which is great, but when you're kind of like an introverted person like I am, it's been a really steep learning curve for me, I think, being open and sharing my personal thoughts and opinions in such a public way. It's terrifying, absolutely terrifying. And I'm finding it easier and easier as I go along, but definitely it's something that I did not know in the beginning. I had no knowledge of the book industry. I'm a massive reader. I read all the time. I've been a reader since I was tiny. I can tell you all about books, but I realized that I knew absolutely nothing about the publishing industry. So even that in itself as well has been a really steep learning curve, just understanding how books are sold, what makes books sell. These are things that I've kind of had to learn along the way. I don't know if knowing them earlier would have helped or hindered, but it's definitely been an interesting learning experience for me.
Did you find that you felt comfortable enough to ask lots of questions, or were you kind of just kind of almost along for the ride?
Think in the beginning, I didn't ask any questions. I felt very much like I'm just going to do as I'm told. You want me to do that? I'll do that. Okay. And it's only now I'm starting to feel, I think, a bit more confident in myself, and I can sort of ask some questions about things I'm being asked to do or say. Yeah, and I think I've been very lucky that I have got very good as the years have gone by. I've had 2 years to get to know my editor, my agent, and my kind of publishing team really, really well. So we've kind of developed friendships as well. So now it's much easier, obviously, to ask questions. But in the beginning, no, I was absolutely terrified of them all.
I think we've all had that feeling, don't worry. So finally, Fiona, I'd love if you could tell us if you're writing anything new at the moment, give us a little tease about what might be next for you.
Oh, geez. I am writing something, and I'm actually very excited about it, which is I'm really pleased about, because I did have that horrible moment last year of feeling like I put everything I know, everything I am into the debut novel, and I was empty. There's nothing left in the pot. There's nothing there. I was thinking, I'm never going to write again because I've got nothing left to say. But I think keeping busy and not focusing on the book in a really weird way and doing lots of other things has allowed me to slowly fill up again with ideas and thoughts. So yes, I am writing something new. It's in the very early stages, so I can't say much about it. But nature will still be there. It's always there. I think
I had a feeling. I had a feeling.
I don't think I can write without it. I think it's always going to be there. Yeah. So.
You write about it beautifully, so that's all good in my opinion. Fiona, thank you so much for joining me on the
Thank
podcast today.
you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really great fun. Thank you.
That was Fiona Williams talking about her contemporary novel, The House of Broken Bricks, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.